Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Coming up later, Steve Fox of PC World is going to talk about the latest on the Justice Department's ebook price fixing case against Apple and five major book publishers. We'll also learn more about the new movie rentals from Google and Amazon and get a peek at Google's Project Glass. Right now, what 13 employee non-revenue generating startup is worth $1 billion to Facebook? Joining us to talk about the Facebook Instagram story is Lex Friedman. Lex is a staff writer for Macworld.com. He's been covering the issue. Welcome to the show, Lex.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Instagram, it's a mobile photo sharing network, and there was a day when I would have thought its 30 million membership was amazing, but it's really a drop in the bucket compared to Facebook. So why is it so special?
It's a great question. You know, like you said, there's 30 million people sharing photos. By now, probably that number is a couple weeks old, and Instagram's been growing at a rapid click since they released an Android app earlier this month, and B, since the news of the Facebook acquisition. So my guess is now they're closer to 40 million. But they're sharing lots of photos each day. The last time Instagram shared numbers, which was a few months back, they said that they were seeing 10 to 15 million photos uploaded to their servers each day. Now, 2 years ago is the last time Facebook shared its own numbers, and Facebook was at that time saying they got 100 million photo uploads from their users each day. So you're right, it's a drop in the bucket. But I think that there's two pieces to this. One is that Facebook wants to own photo sharing online. You know, there have been numerous photo sharing sites. Flickr, which is currently owned by Yahoo but largely neglected by that company, was a big photo sharing site for a long time. But there's pretty much nobody competing with Facebook for photo sharing. And I think they saw Instagram as a site as an app that wasn't really competitive yet, but could be one day. So I think Facebook wants to own it for that reason, so that it can keep owning every photo that's getting shared online. And just as importantly to Facebook, not let anybody else, like a Google or a Twitter or anyone else, come in and snatch up Instagram and start owning those photo uploads themselves.
Okay, so that's good. So, like, why $1 billion?
That's the billion-dollar question, literally. But, it's hard to say. Like you said, Instagram has never made a dollar. It doesn't just, have no revenue. It has no business model. They have no plans to charge for the app, which is free for iPhone and for Android. They have no advertisements in the app, and they say they have no plans to introduce them. And there's no business model, no plan of, here's how we'll start generating revenue. So then you have to ask the question, how do you get to this billion-dollar figure? Is it, am I paying $1 billion if I'm Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook because I want to get these 30 to 40 million users? That's the most likely answer, right? It's not a technology acquisition. The technology used in Instagram isn't especially fancy or complicated,
right,
or difficult to emulate. And I read an analogy online yesterday where someone described it a bit like modern art. You can look at Instagram and you can say, well, I could have made that, but you didn't. And Instagram did, and they got tremendously successful with it. So, to figure out how do you get to the billion-dollar mark, I think that's Facebook exerting a little bit of its financial muscle and saying, we have the money to make sure that we buy this and no one else does. And Facebook literally pulled the trigger on the deal a week after Instagram had raised its latest round of funding, which had valued it at $500 million. So they had to hit the right price point for Instagram to say, yes, we'll go to you. But I'm sure that Instagram had its choice of suitors.
I was going to say they virtually eliminated any kind of bidding war.
Exactly. As soon as somebody can offer $1 billion, the biggest acquisition I can think of that gets, in recent months, or I guess in recent years, is when Google bought YouTube several years back for $2 billion. That was at the time a site that cost a tremendous amount of money, needed an infrastructure much bigger than an Instagram, because it's not just sharing, millions of photos each day, but bandwidth-clogging videos. And Google still, I don't think, would say that it's turned the corner to profitability with YouTube, but it's at least... they have a model now. They show ads before some videos. So clearly, Mark Zuckerberg said pretty plainly on his own Facebook profile when he announced the acquisition, we're not going to change Instagram. We're not going to say that you have to post all of your photos to Facebook or share photos with the people on Facebook. You don't do any of that. And they said, we're not going to start adding in advertisements either. So, to say this is worth $1 billion is to really, I think, put your stake in the ground and say, we want every photo that people are sharing. We want the photo sharing experience to be owned by our company. And we want all the metadata that's associated with, where and what time of day are people snapping photos and sharing them, and what kind of photos are people sharing, and that sort of thing.
And they have $1 billion to blow.
Exactly.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher. My guest right now is Lex Friedman, staff writer for Macworld. We're talking about the Facebook Instagram story. If you have a question or comment for Lex, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go on to Facebook and send your put your question or comment there on our Facebook page. So he says, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg says that he promises that Instagram will remain independent. What do we mean by independent these days, and should Instagram users be wary or skeptical of that?
It's a fair question, because Facebook doesn't have the greatest track record for caring about and protecting user privacy in the way that most of us think about our privacy. But, you know, when what Zuckerberg says pretty clearly on his post on his, you know, his own Facebook page is, you know, we plan on keeping all of Instagram's current features, like the ability to post to other social networks, the ability not to share your Instagrams on Facebook, and the ability to have, you know, followers and follow people separately from your friends on Facebook. And he says, you know, we want to keep the Instagram experience pure the way that it is. And we understand that that's why it's been successful, is because it is the way it is. Now, I honestly do believe that. I don't think that you can spend $1 billion and then immediately start changing things and lose whatever value you got from that acquisition. But if people are concerned, they can, you know, I took the step myself. There are various websites and apps available that are very easily findable on the web right now that you can at least download all of your Instagram photos. So if you're worried that maybe this is going to go away or become something you don't want to use, you can find a way to save all those photos to your Mac or PC so that you can keep them for safekeeping, which, frankly, we should have been doing anyway, we being, you know, 30-plus million Instagram users. Mm-hmm. And now we have a very easy way. There's a variety of free services to make it brain-dead simple to download all those photos. That said, I'm not worried. I still use Instagram. I take lots of pictures of my kids with it, and I'm not going to stop.
There's a small staff I mentioned, 13 people. Is it staff-owned? Who received the $1 billion?
It's a pretty good deal for the people involved.
They're having an office party, I would imagine.
I think so, and I don't think they're sparing any expense. The CEO of Instagram, I believe he's 27 years old, and his name is Kevin Systrom, and he pockets $400 million out of the deal. You know, they have investors to pay off. Like I said, they had that $500 million valuation that had just been reached a week before the deal was closed, but I believe that, you know, they said that you know, he'll get $400 million worth of the deal, and based on his own ownership stake. Mm-hmm. And then the rest, you know, they've got to pay off investors, and then they'll still have plenty of millions left over per employee, although I don't know that they've publicly announced exactly how they intend to divvy that up. But all 13 employees are thus far sticking with the company now that it's part of Facebook.
Right, and when they say they won't make any changes now that it's part of Facebook, structurally, what happens when something like Facebook does buy a little operation like that? Do they just become employees of Facebook then?
Yes.
Okay.
On the employee side, they'll become, you know, employees of Facebook, and Zuckerberg has already said that the one thing that Facebook will do is work behind the scenes. You know, Facebook, probably more than any other company, with the possible exception of Google, has the technology and infrastructure to run just enormous websites doing just massive amounts of web transactions each day. Facebook doesn't, Instagram doesn't need to have all of that benefit yet, but, you know, obviously I think both Instagram people and Facebook people would want to see Instagram have to face those same kind of bandwidth management problems. And, you know, on the technology side behind the scenes, I imagine Facebook will pretty quickly start helping out Instagram.
So are other companies saying, dang, why, you know, didn't we get there first?
What's interesting is Twitter CEO Biz Stone, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, Biz Stone was the co-founder, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey had been very interested in acquiring Instagram, according to reports that I've seen, and was an active Instagram user up until the day that Facebook acquired the company. And he has not posted a single photo on his public Instagram profile since that day.
Well, you know, that's a good point, because barely has Mark Zuckerberg ever used Instagram. He's been plugged into it for a few years now, but barely has used it only four or five times, I guess.
Right. And, you know, that's definitely true for Zuckerberg's public profile. Sort of wonder, does he have a private page that he shares photos with a smaller circle of friends where he doesn't have to worry about everybody seeing them, which is you know, rather ironic given his feelings on privacy and such. But my hunch is that he's used it more than we can tell.
And as far as Instagram goes, there may no changes per se, but could it be improved?
That's a great question. You know, it's when there's I think two different ways that Instagram can really get better. One, when you look at Facebook, by the end of 2012, Facebook will have 1 billion active users. So again, billion with a B. And that's not, you know, number of people with accounts, but people who are actively using the site each week. And, you know, so if Instagram is still just at 30 million, it has a lot of growth potential. Right now, there are days when you can go on Instagram, and unless you follow extremely prolific people, it can still be a bit of a ghost town. 30 million people is a whole lot of people, unless not a lot of your friends are in that 30 million people. So, you know, certainly I think that Facebook's ability to expose the Instagram service to more people could be beneficial, because the more friends who use Instagram, the more fun Instagram is, you know, to see what your friends are seeing and taking pictures of. On the technology side, you know, what Instagram originally became renowned for on the quirkiness side was you don't just take photos and share them with friends. You take photos and then optionally add all kinds of interesting filters to them. And it's not, you know, goofy filters with speech bubbles and special effects, but it's filters designed to take your crisp, clean, freshly taken photograph and make it look as if it were taken with an older camera, you know, a camera in the 70s or even 60s with all kinds of manipulations on that side. And people really like those. And I think that, you know, improving not the app experience, because I think that Instagram's app is generally more usable and superior to Facebook's in numerous ways, but, you know, adding more of those filters and more ways to manipulate your photos that are, you know, very, very one-touch sort of simple filters and effects to apply could be pretty interesting to Facebook's community.
Well, Lex Friedman, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Lex Friedman, he's staff writer for Macworld. Coming up, Steve Fox from PC World. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Time is running out for you to win the new iPad and support 89.7 NPR News. Our spring membership drive begins Thursday, and by becoming a sustaining member early, you'll be automatically entered to win the new iPad. Visit WOSU.org now, make your sustaining gift, and get registered. No pledge is necessary, but your support will continue to pay for the programs you enjoy. Entries are only accepted at WOSU.org. Thanks for supporting 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners and investment managers providing financial advice and client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life at sherringtongroup.com.
56 degrees in downtown Columbus, a mix of sun and clouds today and a high of 64. Cloudy skies tonight, a low of 43, and sunshine Wednesday, another nice day, a high of 69. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Last week, the U.S. Department of Justice filed an antitrust suit against Apple and five publishers for alleged price fixing of e-books. Apple has claimed that its role in the market is polar opposite to a monopoly or collusion. Joining us now to make some sense of this is Steve Fox, editorial director and vice president for PC World Magazine and PCWorld.com. Welcome back, Steve.
Good to be back, Ann.
I was on vacation reading a book on my Kindle when all of this broke.
So, they had very good timing. So, you know, maybe did you miss all of it? Of course, the other question is, how much did you pay for that book on your Kindle?
I did go back and check.
Of course. You know, and that really comes, that's the heart of this question. What happened here is, you know, the Justice Department in several states got together and they sued Apple over the claim that they were fixing prices on electronic books. Of course, this generated a lot of press, even though, of course, you were on vacation, so missed it, but generated a lot of press. And very quickly, three of the companies that were part of the suit just folded and said, okay, yeah, you know what, we'll change our behavior here. But that left Apple and essentially one other company, which is their Holzbrink, which is really Macmillan and Penguin Publishing, to fight it out against the Justice Department. And of course, what they're saying is, no way. We're not fixing prices. What we're really doing is we're trying to, fight against what we see as a monopoly. And that monopoly, even though people think of this as an Apple story, it's really an Amazon story, because Amazon just figures so broadly in this in the entire drama. Amazon, in many ways, there are many things about them that do feel somewhat like a monopoly, right? Everybody knows you can get all of this material, all of the reading material that you want at very good prices, usually under $10 for, mm-hmm. for new books from Amazon. And of course, when these books are that inexpensive, that puts a lot of pressure on anyone else who's trying to sell books. In this case, it would be Apple and the publishers. And so, in many ways, this is a classic antitrust. Think Standard Oil or American Tobacco Company or even Microsoft more recently. It's about an accusation that there might be some sort of restraint of competition, and that somebody is trying to set prices. And when that happens, the DOJ tends to get involved.
It all started because back in late 2010, the five major publishers and Apple switched to the so-called agency model for ebook pricing. What's the agency model?
Well, the agency model, it's really a question of who is setting the price of books. Right. So when you have in the case of where things were going before, essentially you have Amazon setting the price of books and saying, look, you guys, you got to come in, under $10 for major books. And that had worked for quite some time, certainly for consumers. But, the agency model says that the publishers are the ones who are setting the price. Now, what's kind of amusing in all of this...
Okay, go ahead.
I'm sorry, go... Yeah. Yeah, is that, Apple in this case is not only was saying you need to set prices at a certain level, but they're also demanding their 30% cut on whatever was sold. So, in fact, for publishers, it wasn't always better to have the higher price, because, a higher price with a large percentage taken out by Apple isn't necessarily a good thing. Amazon really is able to strong-arm publishers. I mean, it is fair to say this. They can strong-arm publishers into offering very deep discounts because, let's face it, if we're buying books, we would rather pay less for them. So, they can say, sorry, you're going to have to come in at a lower percentage. Amazon will take their percentage. And, consumers perhaps are happy, but it's a huge threat to the, conventional, longstanding practice of the way books are sold. And when I say books, I'm talking about, physical books. Obviously, when you're talking about ebooks, there are some different rules. What's the real cost of an ebook or the ebook distribution, right? A lot of arguments say that Amazon had been selling books, offering them at a loss, right? And, that would be a classic way that, people can build a monopoly. You sell things below cost, because it allows you to monopolize a market. Mm-hmm. But when you think about it realistically, on a book, by the time you're selling it as an electronic book, most of those costs are already sunk, right? I mean, certainly there's marketing costs and there's paying the authors and everything else. But, with physical books, you also have paper and printing and distribution. For an electronic book, the costs to distribute are actually incremental. So I'm having a little trouble understanding the theory that they're selling at a loss when, in fact, this is all incremental sales.
If Apple is requiring 30% off the top, what is it about what they're doing that isn't strong-arming publishers as well?
Well, I mean, it is strong-arming publishers in certain ways, except that they're doing it in cooperation with the publishers. The publishers really want to make sure that they can keep the value and the price of books high enough that they have reasonable perceived value. Mm-hmm. I think that's certainly an important idea here. The publishers would rather sell the books for more, even if it means they have to kick in more to Apple. Now, Apple is not a huge player in this market yet,
right?
And they could well be. Amazon is clearly the the monster here, and then you have Barnes & Noble, and maybe in third or so you've got Apple. But, you know, establishing for the publishers, establishing a credible third source that can chip away at Amazon, which they see as, a force that just lowers their own value and price, you can see why publishers might want to do that. I mean, I think what's funny here is that if you asked either side in this dispute, you know, they'd say both sides would say they're on the side of the angels, mm-hmm. right? In fact, you know, I think that Apple would argue that they are trying to stop monopoly, even as they are being hit with an antitrust suit. And if you ask Amazon, they would say, what can be bad about forcing publishers to lower prices on books? First off, you get more people buying the books, and you know, so I think both sides really think that they're trying to stop unfair practices.
My guest is Steve Fox. He's editorial director, VP of PC World. We are talking about the U.S. Department of Justice's antitrust suit against Apple and five publishers for alleged price fixing of e-books. If you have a question or comment for Steve, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go on to Facebook and post your question or comment there, or tweet me, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. They reached a settlement with three of the publishers. Correct me
right.
if I'm wrong, but Hatchett, HarperCollins, and Simon & Schuster.
Right.
But they proceeded with, and they did not, none of those publishers admitted fault.
Right. Well, and that is standard in this
mm-hmm.
kind of
right.
thing. There's an agreement. And actually, the agreement is stipulated it's for, you know, a specific amount of time. But they said, what the three publishers, said in this case, is that they would not restrict, limit, or impede any ebook retailer's ability to set or change or even reduce the price of an ebook. So, in other words, they will not price fix by definition. That does not mean they can't offer discounts, right? They can the retailers, and here's the difference between the publishers and the retailers, and that's where we get into this question of the agency model again. That retailers can offer discounts or other promotions or any other way that they want to in order to sell ebooks. I believe it's for something like at least 2 years. So, you know, I think the effect on all of this is we may get back to pretty much where we were before. For Apple, they would say, well, that's not a good situation because we're just, you know, propping up Amazon's monopolistic position. And, of course, again, what you'd have from Amazon saying, we're going to continue offering books at reasonable prices.
Will the consumers see any part of the settlement? Now, well, how much, first of all, do they say this cost consumers over the course of that 18 months or so?
Right. Well, when the original antitrust was filed, they came up with some figures, and I was trying to figure out, you know, how they came up with these numbers. And, you know, there's some logic to it. At least there was at least one attorney general that said, this is the Connecticut attorney general, put the cost of this to consumers at something like $100 million, which seems like a pretty large figure. I was somewhat surprised to see it. But I guess the idea here is if you added $2 to $3 to the price of most books, ultimately that's going to add up to some real money. Now, I think what will happen here is that we will see a continuation of very vigorous discounting on Amazon's part. You know, part of the issue here is controlling the distribution. Keep in mind that Amazon, along with selling pretty much everything you can think of, they also have a very good distribution mechanism specifically for ebooks with the Kindle, and more recently with the Kindle Fire and the like. You know, Barnes & Noble, obviously, they also have their device, the Nook, and then you have Apple with their own device with the iPad. So everyone is controlling both the distribution and the device on which it's read in this case. So it's hard to argue here that consumers don't have a choice in different ways of getting their material. A lot of people just absolutely love the iPad and are going to want to read books on the iPad. And, you know, others are big fans of the Kindle. So there is consumer choice here. The question is, you know, what the prices will be moving forward. You often see in things like textbooks and you know, more very expensive books, the difference in price between a physical printed book and, say, textbooks and other things, and the electronic book is really quite small. So, you know, I think there's still some work to be done here. It doesn't entirely make sense to me that there would be such a small difference in the price of these books once they go electronic. I mean, keep in mind, you know, I work for a publisher, and we absolutely expect, as all authors should, we expect that authors should be paid, so it's not an argument about that. It's a question of setting what is a fair price and, you know, making sure that the market does what the market does and moves towards a correct pricing model.
Why did those three settle, and, for instance, Macmillan not? The Macmillan CEO, John Sargent, said that the Department of Justice and Macmillan had been in discussion for months. What didn't work for them?
Well, you know, they just insisted that there was no collusion. I mean, that's their point is, you know, yeah, we may have said that we want prices to be at a certain level, but there was no collusion involved. There was a point here where they said, you know, it's hard to admit fault when you don't think there was any fault involved.
Right.
Whereas I think for the publishers who did give in, you know, who knows? You know, it's also possible that they were not, you know, quite as enamored of the Apple model as some of the others. It's really hard to know, you know, what's going on there.
As far as that goes, was this a Steve Jobs thing or?
Well, you know, what's funny is when you read the Steve Jobs book or, you know, take a look at their kind of activity, you know, Jobs did stuff like this all the time, you know, getting in a room with people and saying, here's what music costs, you know, here, you want a track, that will cost 99 cents and that's what we'll set it at. Or, you know, in many ways, you know, we applaud this, but, you know, it's kind of a backroom deal in certain ways. And, you know, in that case, when we're talking about, say, music, there wasn't another reasonable avenue for people at that point to be getting electronic music or, you know, widely available. Obviously, there were some other ways, but in terms of availability. So when there's a price that's set and it's 99 and most people shrug their shoulders and say, yeah, you know, that sounds right. And, you know, that's the way it was set. In this case, it's kind of got some broader implications. And I think, you know, in that case, you've got many more players who are able to distribute the materials. So it's very likely that you're going to have a more contentious situation than you would in, say, music. You know, say it's basically the same sort of thing that's happening with movies, with any kind of media like this, where electronic distribution comes along and has the potential to upset old business models. You know, I think that a lot of people feel that ultimately that Amazon is actually bad for booksellers, at least in the long term. You certainly get a lot of, well, certainly competing booksellers, but even bad for publishers. And the idea that by reducing prices to certain levels, you devalue the worth of what it is that you're actually distributing. And that becomes very hard for publishers then. So really, for the publishers who were tied into a distribution model and a publishing model that was built around print, and that's really the key factor here. It was built around an old style. They haven't really necessarily embraced a new method of distribution. And, you know, a lot of these new things that are coming along are threats to that sort of model.
Scott Turow, of course, the author, but he's also president of the Authors Guild, said that, ironically, quote, the government may be on the verge of killing real competition in order to save the appearance of competition.
So the point here is, if you think of, you know, what's the greater evil, and, you know, certainly some people would say, well, the greater evil is ultimately one group having entire control of distribution and setting price. And, you know, so that ultimately leads to a monopoly. So that's why I said earlier I was saying kind of the almost funny thing about this is that both sides would claim that they are working against monopoly. And it's hard to say, you know, who's right here. There are certainly, as I look at this from the point of view of a consumer, I very much like getting books for less, as do most consumers. Certainly, if we were to look into some sort of, you know, a darker future where there was only one company that could set all prices and that was the only place to get it, at that point, well, you know, who's to say that prices wouldn't change and get a lot more? You know, now, Amazon has never shown those sort of inclinations. They've always really pushed towards discounts. But that's what gets people, plenty of people, worried.
Loss leaders. Gene in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Gene.
Yes, thank you. I happen to think Amazon is a very easy, smooth shopping process. But I worry about, you know, just what we're talking about, whether it be books or other products. Without necessarily naming names, should I be looking around the web and finding other shopping experiences that have the same sorts of guarantees and one-click shopping, et cetera, and nice, easily formatted web pages that Amazon does?
Well, first off, you know, it's an interesting question. It's hard to find a frictionless experience like Amazon offers anywhere else. They are just so much better at this than anyone else. You know, nonetheless, it's worth shopping around. The beauty of the web itself is that it's a perfect market. You can find things. You've got search engines, so you can search for books and other things elsewhere. So it's certainly worth looking for it. You know, at this point, I don't see the huge threat from Amazon. That's not to say it couldn't happen at some point.
Thank you, Gene. An email from Paul, he asks, what restrictions are placed on books and other writings published in Apple's ebook format? I read somewhere that Apple owns the rights of the ebook, but don't know the specifics.
Yeah, I wish I do not know the specifics, but the primary thing I know about what Apple does, you know, Apple is kind of famous for being control freaks. I don't think many people would argue that point, is that they absolutely set a price that they insist on getting. So, you know, whatever happens, Apple is going to get their cut. I'm actually not sure about the other restrictions, and I'll certainly look into that.
The Consumer Federation, I know you're no lawyer, but the Consumer Federation of America, you might be a lawyer, I don't know.
No, I'm not. I'm just an editor. What can I say?
The Consumer Federation of America calls it a slam dunk for the Department of Justice. Is that pretty much the common viewpoint?
No, I don't think there is a common viewpoint. You know, as you look around on the web, and certainly from the various lawyers, you know, antitrust is tricky business. So I don't think anyone's saying it's a slam dunk. I think in general, most people feel that offering books for less money so that consumers are paying less is a good thing, right? And so because of it, you know, the Department of Justice has a lot of energy on their side because of this. And they probably are not going to be bringing this unless they think they have a pretty strong case here. You know, then again, these things, you know, tend not to end quickly. I suspect that this is not the end of this chapter by any means.
This is full employment for some set of lawyers out there.
Exactly. And yeah. just suggest that, you know, in another life, we should all come back as antitrust lawyers.
Right. Well, for now, Steve Fox, we're stuck doing what we're doing, and I appreciate you joining me in it.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ann.
Steve Fox, he's editorial director and vice president of PC World Magazine and PCWorld.com. Coming up, Russell Holly from Geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The discovery of penicillin and its effectiveness against bacteria saved countless lives and revolutionized medicine. Science writer Carl Zimmer says virologists are waiting for their penicillin moment, but they're getting close. On the next Fresh Air, he'll tell us about innovative strategies for fighting viruses. Also, we talk with the Dutch jazz drummer Han Benink. Join us.
Anne. and Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. WOSU Public Media and The Refectory present a Chefs in the City VIP dinner with world-renowned chef Hubert Keller. On Wednesday, May 2nd, you can dine with Chef Keller, enjoy a five-course dinner with wine pairings, and bid on unique culinary-themed packages. Tickets are on sale now, but seating is very limited. Visit WOSU.org/chefs or call 614-292-4337 to purchase your tickets now.
Support for 89.7 comes from John Glenn School of Public Affairs, offering graduate degree programs designed for the working professional. More information online at glenn.osu.edu or at an information session on April 17th or 18th.
56 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies today and a high of 64. Clouds tonight, a low of 43. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Today on Tech Tuesday, we're going to learn more about the new movie rentals from Google and Amazon. And get a peek at Google's Project Glass. Joining us now is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks for having me back.
Pre-theatrical rentals, meaning you can see the movie, and it's not just one of the junky movies. You can see the movie before it hits the theaters. How can that be? How can Amazon and Google do that?
So this is strangely not a new concept. This is something that's been done a couple of times since, you know, digital movies have kind of become a thing, really since the late 90s. But what made this particular experience that I had interesting was that it seemed like the closest thing to a complete thought that I've seen. Basically, the way that the experience was set up for this one particular movie, the night before the movie was available in theaters, you had the option to rent the movie from Amazon for 2 days. You could watch it once, or you could watch it as many times as you wanted within those 2 days. But you had a 2-day rental period. Once you started watching the show, if you just purchase the rental, you had up to 30 days to watch it. But then once you actually hit the play button, you had 2 days to finish the movie, basically. And you could pause and stop and rewind as many times as you wanted. The next day, the movie hit the box office. People who wanted to go see the movie in the theater could go see the movie in the theater. And when the movie leaves the box office, the movie will be available to purchase from iTunes and Amazon and Google Video.
So what's the cost?
The movie rental itself for this particular movie was $10. And it cost, you know, so it was basically $1.50 more than what I would pay for the theater down the street from me. And
but I wouldn't spend another $15 on popcorn, Reese's Pieces, and a bottle
of water.
I
mean, you know, unless you had that stuff, you know, in the home, you know, and you'd be able to do that as well, or watch it over a movie. The point is that you could really control this movie going experience without, you know, the box office, you know, losing any money. I mean, the theater itself loses the money by default because, as you just pointed out, they're not buying popcorn or, you know, or candy or those things. But the movie studio itself is making, you know, probably more money off of this. And as a result, it becomes a more complete thought, in my opinion, because you can watch the movie. You can, you know, reach out to your friends and say, hey, this was a really great movie. They can go catch it in the theater, or they can rent it if they choose to. And then instead of waiting that 9 months from when a movie leaves the theater, it's immediately available for purchase when it leaves the box office.
Well, what about the theaters? What do they think about this?
I haven't gotten a lot of response from individual theaters, but this was a movie that was, you know, this movie in particular was available in select theaters, so it wasn't available in every theater. Mm-hmm. But the response was so great that the production company wants to start doing it with other movies. And obviously, I mean, so the conflict that I had here was that there are absolutely movies where I want that box office experience. You know, I'm not necessarily a fan of 3D, but, you know, someone who has, you know, a really nice home stereo system, a really nice home theater setup, could probably get away with watching most movies at home using this setup. But there are definitely movies where I feel like I would benefit from that, you know, that crazy big screen in the theater and the real nice sound system. But that's not true of all movies. There are a lot of movies that I would pay to watch at home that I probably wouldn't go all the way out to the theater to watch.
So we haven't gotten much feedback from the theaters on this, though. They can't be for it because that's their loss leader. That's what brings them in. I imagine they make the money on the $3 or $4 bottle of water.
Oh, I'm sure.
What about the difference between streaming and downloading new releases? You can do it into anything? Can you do it into, if you have a smart television, can you do it into that?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you could watch it on your smart television. You could download it on your iPhone. You could watch it. Amazon's video service is pretty flexible in that way. You know, if you rent something from Amazon, there are a lot of different things you can watch it on, including their new Kindle Fire. And there's a lot of flexibility there.
And it means you can watch it without the whole internet connection and everything.
Yeah, you can choose to download it and watch it, you know, where no matter where you are. The way that Amazon is set up, you're allowed to download it two times. So you can have two copies of the video that exist. And then the way that the digital rights management system works for that is that the video becomes unplayable after that 48-hour period when you've hit the play button.
Okay, my guest, Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a question or comment for Russell, I don't think anybody's nailed you yet with something you couldn't respond to, Russell. So I'm always waiting to see if we want to stump the tech blogger. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go on to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and you can tweet me at Ann Fisher WOSU. Let's move on to Project Glass. Of course, if anybody wants to talk about the Amazon, Google movies, new movie experience, you can call us and ask about that. But moving on to Project Glass, it's Google's new project. I don't know why they call it Project Glass, but I'm always questioning the titles they give things. It proposes a piece of technology that really is reminiscent of Star Trek.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so essentially what happens here is you've got, really just kind of half of a pair of these futuristic-looking glasses that get set on your head, and it takes this, no wider than an inch piece of glass and has it hovering just a little tiny bit above your eye and projects, information onto this little piece of glass. The video that is shown that demonstrates, what this technology could be, because it's pretty far from being finished, really demonstrates a lot of, kind of streamlining the experience that we have now as users of smartphones, getting GPS directions or searching for the restaurant that we're trying to go to, or, making scheduling plans and things like that. All of these things became streamlined in this video as it was just something you did, while you were walking around and kind of had this tiny computer strapped to your head.
Right, but what are you waving your hands in the air? How are you moving from one concept to the next?
So the demonstration that was seen here really seemed like it was a combination of head gestures and voice commands. So the screen was dormant until the person in the video, glanced up a little bit. When he glanced up a little bit, the menu options floated down onto the screen, and he was able to see the menu options on the screen and issue a command with his voice to pick one of those options and go through the information. If he got a notification from an email or something like that, then it would pulse, on that glass for him to see as he received something.
And what about people who really do need their glasses? Because it's something...
they did address that. That was an initial concern that I had as well, but they have actually... made sure that there is a variant of Project Glass that actually connects to existing glasses. So if you're like me and you already have a pair of glasses, then Project Glass would have an adapter that fits onto those glasses, which raises an interesting question for me because I can't imagine being comfortable with the weight difference,
mm-hmm.
On my glasses, to have a tiny computer on one side of my face and not on the other. So it's going to be really interesting to see how they deal with these concepts. Really, the most difficult thing about a presentation about the like this is that it really creates more questions than it answers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so much that we don't know about this yet, but so far it looks really exciting.
The Bluetooth that around people's ears look like they're irritating to me, and yet many people, I see them on lots of people. How much does it? What? How big is it?
So the demonstrations that they've had, and these are, you know, technical demonstrations where they have Google employees that are actually wearing these around town now. Even, you know, one of the you know, owners of Google, Serge Brin, has been seen walking around town with these glasses. And they don't seem, you know, much bigger than a pair of pencils, really, side by side, you know, coming across the side of the face. They don't seem particularly big at all. But, you know, knowing what we know about how smartphone technology and things like that works, it really makes me wonder if Project Glass is a standalone device or if it's something that connects via Bluetooth to, like, a cell phone or something like that, because just the battery consumption and you know, just the computational information needed to do those things alone seems like it would not fit in such a narrow piece of technology.
What is the rollout? Did they give any indication about how long it could be before, you know, you don't have to be the owner of Google to wear one? Where is it?
So, you know, the whole point of releasing this is, as you know, Project Glass, is that it was just kind of a heads up that this was something exciting that they were working on and to kind of give us a clue of what's going on. I imagine that we will see a lot more about this technology at Google's developer conference in June, which they call Google I.O.,
mm-hmm.
Where they will more than likely have a lot more information about this technology there, and probably even, you know, copies of this technology for other people to put on and wear around. And I will try just about any new piece of technology once, so I'm sure that I'll do whatever I can to get a pair on my head.
You know, I read a column by Russ Douthat of the New York Times. He wrote in an essay that in the main, the Google glasses might feel like, or a man might feel like king of infinite space, but he might actually be inhabiting a comfortable full-service cage, that the Google glasses are a way to further isolate the individual, and that the same technology that makes them possible could also make possible the pervasive citizen surveillance state in which everything you see and do can be recorded, reported, subpoenaed, you name it.
There's a lot of kind of fear, uncertainty, and doubt that goes along with you know, any kind of emerging technology, and Project Glass is certainly not going to be any exception to that, especially given, you know, that the purpose of the internet has kind of seemed to turn into this, you know, how much data can we collect for our benefit or for your benefit, you know, however it wants to be phrased. So there's obviously, you know, some serious questions along those lines that have to be answered. You know, how much is, you know, how much of this information are we willingly handing over to Google? But it's one of these situations, in my opinion, where, you know, there are pretty finite limits to the kind of information that people are willing to give up if they're aware of it. And that's going to be the biggest thing here, is awareness.
Gail in Clintonville, you're on the air with an off topic. We welcome off topic. Thanks for joining us.
Well, yes, it has to do with photography and photo editing on the iPad. I'm used to using Photoshop, which I love, on my desktop computer to do all sorts of editing and cropping and enhancing with photos. Well, I just purchased a little device for sucking the image from my camera right into my iPad. And I want to know, I think I went on the App Store, and I know their Photoshop has some apps, but I was also told that the iPhoto is quite good, too. So I want to know which is the best photo editing app, iPhoto or something that Photoshop puts out.
Well, I mean, that's definitely a good question to ask. You know, Apple has spent a lot of time and resources into making iPhoto as good as possible for the iPad, and they certainly are great for what most people would call, you know, kind of an intermediary level, you know, photo fan, someone who likes to take pictures and just kind of play with them casually. But in my experience, people who are comfortable with Photoshop really adjust to the Photoshop app on all of the different mobile devices really quickly. It allows them to kind of engage the workflow that they're already used to. So it's really a personal preference at that point, because, you know, the Photoshop app and the iPhoto app on the iPad, neither one of them are going to allow you to do really advanced things when it comes to photos. They're both relatively basic photo manipulation tools. So it really just depends on your personal workflow at that point. If you're comfortable with Photoshop, personally, I'd say go with the Photoshop app. But the iPhoto app is going to take more advantage of the technologies that Apple has included in the iPad, meaning, photos will render faster if you're trying, more advanced techniques and things like that, because the application is going to take more advantage of the processor that Apple has put in that tablet.
Thank you, Gail.
Hello?
Yep.
Let me ask you this. When I went to the App Store, there's several versions of Photoshop, and I'm just wondering, there's one free version, but then there's other more advanced ones. Does he recommend a certain Photoshop application over another for the iPad?
I would definitely recommend Adobe's Photoshop, and the free version, if memory serves, is actually just kind of a trial where it allows you to test out some of the basic features. If that ends up being enough for you, then perfect. But in most cases, I think you'd probably be happier with the paid app.
Okay, Gail, thank you. We have an email from Sam. He writes, I waited until the very last minute to do my taxes. I always wait. I love to live on the edge. But I tried to use TurboTax this morning, and it said my computer cannot support it. I need to upgrade. I have an old Mac laptop, really old apparently. Upgrading is expensive, and buying a new laptop today is even more expensive. What would be better to get my taxes done today?
Oh, my. To get your taxes done today, I would say...
Lotus, the nearest tax...
Yeah, no kidding. Go to a tax store because, there could be any number of things. It really depends on how old the Mac is as far as what's wrong with it. It could just need more RAM, or it could need a faster processor. And one of those is certainly more expensive than the other, not to mention, the trouble of, kind of installing it yourself. And a new computer, like you said, is not only expensive, but it kind of takes a while to set up. So, I would head to a tax professional, and make that computer decision when you're not under so much duress.
And they really can just upload it, I guess would be the way, mm-hmm. pretty quickly. And
they're very efficient now with that.
Before you know it, you'll know how much you owe, Sam, because if you were getting money back... I hope you would file sooner than that. Russell Holly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Oh, we do have time. So real quick, then let's talk about that. there I go again. The little tank bot.
Yeah, so we actually talked a couple weeks ago about this weird little thing that connects to your phone. It is a little robot that rolls around on the floor called Spiro.
Mm-hmm.
And... It's this really, kind of crazy thing that rolled around. It was really just kind of an expensive toy. It was really expensive. It was like $130.
Right.
And the bottom line there was that was really just too expensive for most people. I was cruising through a Radio Shack a couple of days ago, and I came across this tank bot. It's this little tiny robot with tank treads, and it has a connector for your smartphone, be it your Android phone or your iPhone, that gives you that exact same functionality. You can play with this little robot across your desk, and you can drive him around. And he was only $30.
There you go, for Father's Day.
That's right.
All right. Well, thanks again, Russell Holly, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me back.
And by the way, you can go to irs.gov if you want to file for free out there. Sam, thanks for listening to us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, providing a disciplined approach to help individuals and small businesses grow and maintain their wealth. TheMontgomerySolution.com.